to episode 5 of the Furrow Furry podcast. We may as well be completely upfront about the gestation of this episode. We're now on the PWO network, and we've had all of our episodes before this uploaded. Episode 5, though, did encounter a few issues, I'll be honest.
One main issue.
You're a fucking idiot.
Which is that I am an absolute ring piece. And I basically, I've got a new laptop, and I managed to, in the transferring of files over from my old one, delete a lot of stuff that I shouldn't have done. And George's parts were fine. David's parts were fine, but mine disappeared. So actually, pretty much most people at home are probably thinking, well, that would be a bonus. But unfortunately, we've decided to re-record it. So hello, my name is Daniel. And as I previously mentioned, I'm here with my compadres, George and David. And we are going to be carrying on this episode talking about the UWFI and New Japan feud. So I think maybe, George, if you want to just give people a reminder of where we left off the last time, and then we can maybe get into finishing off talking about this this event and this dome show.
Yeah, sure. I mean, before I do so, I'd just like to point out that when we recorded this the first time, as you might know, there is a little bit of a lag between when we record these and when we release them. I mean, I think by the time episode 4 came out, we were talking about the this amazing hot, like, New Japan Noah angle, and we were praising it to the high heavens. And, like, by the time the episode was actually released, the two groups had severed all ties. So things like that can happen. But I just want to point out that it was November the 4th, 2016, when we actually recorded this episode the first time. And so for reasons that may become clear due to certain occurrences a few days later, you know, I think the episode that was lost to the mists of time might have been a little bit more upbeat than what we're about to do. And my God, it was not particularly fucking upbeat at all. Here's where we are in the timeline. So it's the 9th of October, 1995, still. The Tokyo Dome Show, New Japan versus UWFI. It's an 8-match series, and I think I'm right in saying New Japan are currently 2 matches to 1 up.
Yep.
In the series. It's mostly been undercard guys. We had a very, very good tag team match in the opener, which I think we would all urge you to check out.
Yeah.
And coming up next is a match that I think people would have looked at this card at the time and gone, oh, fucking hell, this is going to be something special. It is representing New Japan, the legendary Jushin Liger, and UWFI is represented by Naoki Sano. Now, this was an absolutely huge feud in New Japan's junior heavyweight division in 1989 to 1990. There's one match in particular where I think it's Liger who bleeds a gasket. One or possibly both of them does.
Yeah, it's Liger, and it's the one where the mask gets torn. And it's just a straight up like hate brawl, which is really interesting to see from Liger at that point. Yeah,
I think I mentioned this the last time, but it has one of my favourite spots of all time, where when the mask is ripped, the whole idea was that when Liger was unmasked as Fuji Yamada, when he started as a young lion, he used the Shooting Star Press, and then he retired it when he became Jushin Liger because he didn't want people to know he was Fuji Yamada. But in this match, they tear the mask off of him to reveal he's Fuji Yamada, and then he hits him with a Shooting Star Press, but he's suddenly transformed back into Fuji Yamada, which I thought was a fantastic piece of continuity. Favourite bits in any match. I love it so much.
Yeah. And exactly the kind of thing that you would expect from someone that puts so much thought into his work as Liger does.
I mean, do you remember that match where I think it's Liger versus Muto? I think it's when Muto unmasked him and Liger's got like, he's got fucking face paint on.
Yeah.
And it's like he's awoken, sort of Liger's final form, this really dark, evil version of him, which is, yeah, that's a really cool stuff. So basically, Sano was a bit like Tiger Mask Satoru Sayama in that he was a very good junior heavyweight worker in the style at the time. But what he really wanted to do was to do shoot style. And so by this time, he'd ended up in UWFI. Now, actually, although you might not know this because he's known for his innovative, high flying, and you know, really memorable look with the costume and the horns and the hair and everything. Yeah. Liger was actually a really great amateur wrestler when he was younger. In 1981, he got to the final of the Japanese High School Championship in his weight class, and I think we talked about this last time. You two lads, do you know who his opponent was?
I'm going to pretend that I don't, just for the purposes of this.
There'll be a lot of this.
But George, who was it? Exchange. I'm totally clueless.
Yeah. I've got no idea who it could be, George. Like,
well,
could you tell us?
Well, gentlemen, his opponent was one Toshiaki Kawada.
Never!
No, are you sure?
Get out of town, you mad bastard. But,
Jesus Christ. Like...
Yeah, Liger versus Kawada, who, as far as I know, they never had a singles match in their pro careers. And I think we're on opposite sides of a tag match maybe once or twice. I know certainly Liger was only in the one match with Misawa.
Yeah, I've just had a mini kind of internal orgasm at the very thought of that match. Like, Jesus, imagine how good that would be. Oh, carry on, everyone, carry on.
So every so often
I do a Google search for traditional Liger versus Mitsuharu Misawa, just in case. checking his cage match every so often, just to make sure somebody's not found one.
Yeah.
It comes up.
Give it up. It's like Hypnodisc versus Razor. You're never going to find it.
No, absolutely. This match, I think we'll get into in a moment, I guess, some of the elements of this match which maybe we think suit the environment that it's being that it's being presented in, and also maybe some of the things that we think maybe are a little bit different, I suppose, to how some of the other matches have been presented here as well. Maybe we can get into some chat about the match itself now we've done a bit of background.
The way in which it starts is quite a good indication of maybe how this match straddles the line between the general New Japan Junior Heavyweight style and the shootier stuff that UWFI were doing. And the first match is the first move of the match, Jushin Liger does a Kobo kick. If you don't know what that is, it's the sort of, you do a forward roll and you kick them with the foot that's going round. If you watch the UK Championship on the WWE Network, which we mentioned earlier, that's something that Tyler Bate was doing as a move to set up for his finisher, and it's a really cool strike. Liger actually did one of these in an MMA fight with Minoru Suzuki that may or may not have been a work. Now. Daniel, well, you've just come from some sort of martial arts class. presumably, doing a Kobo kick is the first thing they fucking teach you at the dojo.
Well, all we say is that work or no work, it was definitely organised by legitimate businessmen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, just to give the people that are listening some kind of context, I think this is basically my sort of celestial punishment for having fucked up the last episode, I've actually come straight from my Muay Thai class, that sounds kind of cool and I think it's worth pointing out that I am utter dog shit at Muay Thai. I am absolutely bollocks. Right now I would probably be all right because I've been doing it for about 3 years or so, but I have loads of bad anxiety problems and depression and things, and it basically means that I don't train for like 6 months. I have to start again every time. So I've come straight from there and we were practicing leg kicks, and I've not even had a shower, I've still got my shorts on, and I'm aching all over. So yeah, I will say this: we have never been taught that kick. I've been going for a while. We've never been taught that kick. Not in Thai, not in MMA, not in any of the classes that I've done has that kick ever come up. So
Have you tried it? Oh, God, you may not have been taught it, but I could see you pulling out a Kobo kick and sparring.
Oh man, I can't even head. I can't even get my foot high enough to head kick. And really decent guys can't do that. You know, like, so it's a very complicated thing to try and pull off. Let alone in what might have been possibly maybe a shoot against a guy that really, really knew what he was doing. So if anyone wants to watch this, you can find this on YouTube or Daily Motion pretty easily. It's one of the great car crash kind of 30 seconds. In pro wrestling combat sports crossovers. It's very strange, especially because in the fine tradition of Alberto Del Rio,
yes.
choo-choo, party time. He wears the mask during the match, which is just like, I mean...
Didn't Kendall Cashin do that? Kendall Cashin did that as well.
Yeah, Kendall Cashin did as well.
But Kendall Cashin is dog shit.
There's a fine tradition of people that should not be in there with guys that know what they're doing wearing masks to fight.
Do you think that the Lucha Commission would frown upon it if Del Rio was to start wearing the Dos Caras Jr. mask again to hide his identity from the Austrian police? Or possibly from a vengeful knight family?
I mean, that's a whole nother fucking, like, that's a dark wormhole we could go.
I've said it once, I'll say it a thousand times. When Alberto Del Rio was in Pride, Paige was in primary school, right? Every time we watch Total Divas and they appear, I mention it to my wife, who doesn't know what the fuck Pride is, but I make sure she knows he got knocked out by Crow Cop.
It would be good if she got it confused for the film. Alberto Del Rio was in Pride.
The LGBT classic.
Yeah. Like, Alberto Del Rio, well known for his being a prime mover in Lesbian and Gays Against the Minors. Against the Minors? That's a different film. Against the Minors?
Maybe that was the destiny of which he spoke.
that's the sequel. That's the sequel in which they turn on the miners. Back to this wrestling match.
Yes, Liger, he teases a dive very, very early. Obviously, we were not seeing dives in the earlier matches, even from someone like Shinjiro Otani, who was, he was capable of them. I mean, he broke his ankle in fucking North Korea attempting one, but that's another story. And I think it's a mistake to class Liger primarily as a flyer, although you may know as, like, you know, innovative, high-flying stuff like the shooting star press, which he invented. But strikes and submissions are probably a more important part of his game. And certainly nowadays, when he might be able to do a shooting star press, probably not a fucking good idea considering he's like 51, 52. And so he's become more of a ground-based and strike-based wrestler. And, you know, he always had that in his arsenal. And he's still fantastic at doing stuff like that. The submission work is... it's a bit strange in this match, I felt, and not so much because the work was bad or weirdly executed, because it wasn't, although it is less shooty than in previous matches. It's more like the sort of stuff you'd find in maybe 70s wrestling. It's much less messy than some of the stuff that we've covered before. But it's very weird because the crowd goes wild for this quite unrealistic spot where they're sort of, I guess... a test of strength spot turns into mat grappling and then flipping back and forward and stuff like that. And the crowd absolutely adores that. And then Liger attempts an armbar and they don't react, which is really strange. I mean, this, as we said before, this isn't a UWFI crowd. This is very much a crowd of primarily New Japan fans.
One thing I wanted to mention just about Liger in terms of the submission work you mentioned. This is October 95, is that right? Is this one? Is it around October 95 this year? I know that, like, he changed his submission style up. He really worked on that. It was after his brain tumour. When he had that removed, he had the brain surgery to remove the tumour. That was when he kind of moved away from the style. And that was, I would have been about October 96. Because I remember he was at Starcade against Mysterio. And they mentioned that he'd only been out for a couple of very, very short period of time, like a month or two. So
yeah, because, it was the J Crown tournament in 1996, which happened in August at the same time as the G1.
Yeah.
That was to unify eight junior heavyweight championships. And Liger jobbed in the first round in like 2 minutes. And and everyone thought that was a bit weird. And then there was like, no, guys, I literally have brain cancer. Got to go and take care of that. Got to go and give that a shote.
It's a good job he wasn't on workfare, because they'd probably still try to get him in for a fucking meeting. sorry.
Ian Duncan-Smith, we are calling you out.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, check us out. It's like Beyond the Fringe, but, like, you know, a bit more grotty.
I don't know if I've ever mentioned this, but one of my friends spent New Year's Eve at his house.
Well, sorry, for a second then I was like, who, Peter Cooks?
No, Ian Duncan Smith. And basically, I got a text from him. I was in bed watching Batman Returns because I was having a fucking wild New Year. And I just got a text from my mate saying, we're doing karaoke in Singing as Time Goes By. Which is weird because that's like, time going by is the thing like, you know, the Conservative Party seems to hate. But the other thing was, and just quickly, so apparently there was a party once at involving some young people at Ian Duncan Smith's house, and it was like his son's birthday or something. Everyone goes, I think we might have to cut this due to fucking libel, but I want to tell you it anyway.
No, it's all right. It's
all right. So basically, so Ian Duncan Smith's son had a birthday party, and a bunch of them decided to like get absolutely wasted, and it was about 1 or 2 in the morning. Now Ian Duncan Smith, he was in the cabinet, but like his wife is the one with all the money. Like she's very rich, and so they have a big fuck off house with like a pool on the side. And about 1 or 2 in the morning, some of the absolutely wasted people decided, like, let's go skinny dipping. And so they took all the clothes off and got in the pool. And then one of them decides to get to the top of the slide, completely billy bollocks. He's about to go down. And suddenly a light comes on in the upstairs bedroom and Ian Duncan Smith is staring out at him.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my goodness. Like, oh, this is... You see, this is what I love about doing this podcast is that We all have this like incredibly diverse range of life experiences and friendship groups. It's probably the only professional wrestling podcast where you're gonna find like a story about the former and reviled work and pension secretary having a party with some adolescents getting bollock naked on his premises.
Saying that, I once went to Ian Duncan Smith's house for Christmas. I pulled a cracker with him. Do you know what the joke inside was? What'd you call a fly with no wings? Fit to work.
For fuck's sake.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Allegedly.
That should catch all disclaimer. So,
God, where were we? Carry on, George.
Yeah, okay, so the other thing is they don't react for the armbar, which was like a killer move in UWFI, but they do go mad for the octopus stretch because that's an Inoki move. Later on in the match, Liger goes to one of those shoot style planches and goes splat on the floor, which looked pretty painful. And then Sano, similarly, shoot style suicide dive, which gets a massive reaction. At this point, it becomes clear like they're not particularly making much effort to do a UWFI style match, not in the same way that people like Yuji Nagata did or Shinjiro Otani.
Yeah.
This is very much okay. It's a really without the crowd heat and like blood and mask ripping they had 6 years ago. It's very much a greatest hits version of the great matches they were having back then.
But George, have you not seen that Volkan Kosaka match where Volkan does a Tope Suicida out to the side of the ring?
Have you not seen all those Tamura matches where he does red arrows?
I tell you what, Tario Bitsadze had a hell of a 6:30.
Ed Strangler Lewis is having a super kick party.
The only thing he's strangling is my suspension of disbelief.
Is that a bad place for an Altuza joke? Probably. Basically, I think you raised a good point before. You raised this point about how, let's be honest, this is a pretty jarring match in some ways to have in the midst of all this. We spoke last episode about how, in some ways, New Japan are trying to accommodate shoot style, to a more or a lesser extent.
Yeah.
But that perhaps the results of the matches thus far have almost made that a little bit redundant in terms of New Japan coming out on top and with the visual taps and things. But yeah, I think we can maybe go into a bit more depth about this. I mean, in terms of this match, you know, how you said that, what you said there was right, I think. It is a kind of greatest hits package that there's a lot of callbacks to some of their previous matches. It's nowhere near the level of those, like, transcendent, that feud they had. I think it's 89, isn't it, 90, that they have that feud originally. Yeah. Yeah, I mean that because the original that big sort of brawl fest with the blood and the torn mask is one of my favourite Liger matches ever.
Yeah.
But do you think, guys, that this is too jarring, or do you think that it gets away with it?
See, carry on.
Yeah, you first, and then I'll
go. Okay. I really like this, and I really like the positioning. I like the fact that they booked this in the card purely because, I mean, New Japan versus UWFI. The problem is that there is not really much interaction. There's not really much cross-pollination in terms of, you know, established rivals. I like the fact that there was a UWFI guy and a New Japan guy who had history. And to be honest, it really showed in the match, because I felt that there was a really good undercurrent in the match, and that Sano fucking hates Liger, right? And Liger fucking hates Sano. And Sano knows Liger at the back of his hand. He knows every trick in the book. So, like, for example, Liger goes to a surfboard, Sano escapes from it. Liger visibly frustrated. And, you know, he knows that Sano not has his number, but he knows everything. He can do the workarounds. At the start, there was something... I mean, even with the dive, you mentioned about the dive out where Sano jumps out of the way and then does the plancha. It really telegraphed, like, they know each other so well. And I like the fact that there was that sort of history of this match. It does stand out a bit, but to be honest, by this point, I was screaming out for something that stood out. Because, as we probably mentioned the last time, these matches got a bit samey after a while. So I was delighted there was a bit of change.
Yeah, I think the note about the surfboard, I mean, I believe that's how Randy Couture won his third UFC heavyweight championship. That is a classic fucking MMA hold, the Mexican surfboard.
Yeah.
Many shoot style, wow. I think I get what you're saying, and I think, you know, regular listener of ours will know, you know, David is a very big proponent of wrestling having something for everyone and, you know, offering a lot of variety. So I get why, and certainly I think the opener was good, but nothing's been, I think, standout so far. And breaking up the, you know, the shoot style matches, I think, in a sense, it is a good thing to just sort of and make you appreciate the shoot style work when it comes back. Having said that, I think in the context of this feud, I'm not quite sure what it was doing on this show, considering A, that, you know, it was really meant to be, you know, New Japan versus UWFI. And, you know, in the sense, which brings me to my second point, that it was kind of a bit counterproductive to the way they were trying to book it, which is to prove that New Japan could beat UWFI at their own sort of martial arts based game. And I don't think this a match particularly helps the booking in that sense. I mean, we'll come to the stuff that does help the booking a bit later, but that's just one thing I thought. Liger's strikes are absolutely fantastic here. His drop kicks to the knee are really, really good. It does have a hot finish, this match, like you said, David. Getting out of the Sano countering the figure four, which gets a figure four gets a good reaction when it's slapped on. That'll be important later. Then Liger does a lovely backdrop driver, another Koppo kick in the corner, and a pile driver. And then he misses a diving headbutt, which always makes me wince post-Benoit, you know. And then Sano slaps an armbar onto a prone Liger. And that gets a better reaction. So it's quite illustrative that the crowd don't see it as a hold that can finish a match at any time, as a UWFI audience was, but they do see it as a hold that can finish a match in the right context, i.e., you know, 10 minutes into a match when Liger's just stacked it on a big move.
Hmm. And that really plays to the difference in sort of New Japan versus UWFI crowds. Now, I'm by no means an expert on UWFI. I've seen quite a few things, but did they ever do the UFC, you know, like the Ronda finishes where it's like 12 seconds and done? Did they ever do that? Would they have really short matches that just were finishes out of nowhere?
Yes, sometimes they did, yeah. Like, famously, yeah. I think this was maybe 1990, 1991. The main event was Takada versus Bob Backlund, of all the people. And won in about 2 minutes. I think I might have mentioned this as episode four. Takada won in about 2 minutes. And the crowd were a bit pissed because I think in a sense, in their heart of hearts, they sort of kind of knew it wasn't all on the level and they'd maybe get a longer match. And Takada did get on the mic and apologize and say, you know, okay, you know, we'll do a rematch. Yeah. And like, hopefully, wink, wink, it'll be a longer match next time.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, I'm presuming that the Backlund-Takada match that I've seen is that one. Because it's, I actually think it's a really good match, if that's the one I'm thinking of. Because the one I've seen is longer, and it's on the DVD VR, the Death Valley Driver video review, best of UWF or best of other Japan DVD set that they put out, and it's really good. I mean, Backlund's a guy whose career in Japan we could definitely talk about at some point. If a guy can have a match that good with Takada, and then also have one of the ultimate train wrecks of all time against Sasuke. that's our fucking wheelhouse, and we need to get involved in
terms of fucking maniacs, like a cross-Pacific partnership of. I should say Trans-Pacific Partnership, but that's gone down the Swanee as of today. absolute lunacy. That again, we're going to probably properly fucking date ourselves if this ends up getting released in like April or something. it's kind of interesting that happens. Actually, we've got a mate who looks exactly like early 80s Bob Backlund. Pete, if you're watching this, love you.
Is that Pete from our Facebook group?
It is Pete from our Facebook group. Have you never noticed?
I've never noticed that he looks like Bob Backlund.
He really does.
I think I've met him.
You have met him. I don't know what state you were in when you did.
I don't know. Maybe it was the 12-hour-long Megabus or something. But I honestly didn't notice that he looked like Bob Backlund. That's interesting, though.
The other thing I would say is also that when they brought in monsters like Gary Albright and Vader into UWFI, like there's a great match of I think his name is Mark Silver or someone like that, and Gary Albright absolutely murders this poor bastard. This guy's record is like in UWFI is like no wins, 5 losses, 3 draws or something. Yeah. And Albright beats him with a dragon suplex a series of them in like 90 seconds.
Do you know why Gary Albright does that? Do you know how he gets away
with
that?
He's a genuine menace.
He's a genuine menace. shout out to the mysterious Gary.
Then again, like those matches are not so much out of nowhere finishes between like two capable fighters as this big fucker is absolutely destroying this like horribly outmatched opponent. So it's a short like just a short match, but in a different sense. Yeah. So the finish to this. So Liger gets out of this armbar that Sano's got, does a DDT. Sano does a jumping back kick. He loved his back kicks, did Sano, in fact. And in about 10 years' time in Noah, he will only do back kicks.
I was actually going to mention this. I've got this in my notes, so I may as well bring this up. Like, I mean, I don't pretend to be in any way as much of an expert in how matches are put together or how they're structured as maybe some of these guys that are part of the same network we're on. You listen to guys like Dylan and like Chris Zellner and Vix and those guys talking about matches and Chad and those guys, and you're just like, wow, these guys have got a great feel for how matches are put together. I won't put myself at that level, but one observation that I made, and I'm not sure if this is in any way accurate, but I kind of felt like this is probably some of the later stuff that I've seen from Sano. I've seen, as you mentioned, some of the stuff where he's really like, you know, at the end of things. But this is the most I've seen from kind of this period. I've only really seen earlier stuff before this. And I don't know about you guys, but I felt like Liger was leading this quite a lot. I don't know if you think that's a fair thing to say or what, but I felt like there were moments when I really felt like the ramping up of the pace and the transitions between the different spots were kind of on Liger. I don't know if that's just because I'm a massive Liger mark and I see things that way. I don't know if you guys picked up on that. What did you think?
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for that, but I think it's mainly just because there's a bit of a like face heel dynamic going on in so far as Liger is really. You know, he's not sort of he's not fucking the Rock and Roll Express, but like he is clearly like the crowd favorite, and he is resting from, I guess he's the one timing his comebacks in the way that baby faces do. So that's not a dynamic that you really get, certainly in the opener, which felt like enjoyably messy and random in terms of its structure. Like it was very much back and forth, in a very sort of rapid fire way. But yeah, this match certainly, I think its pacing is quite different to that. And so that maybe accounts for it. David, what were you going to say?
Liger was working the match around Sano, and Sano was kind of accentuating it. So for example, as I said, like Sano had his number, so Liger was going for all of his spots and Sano was reversing them. It was more of that, is more Sano in the frustrating role than, say, for example, the Liger. I mean, that's not to say Sano was, you know, sitting in his ass doing nothing. He wasn't, you know, Keiji Muto or anything like that.
Oh, we'll get to Keiji Muto, don't you fucking worry.
We'll get to guys sitting on their ass doing nothing and just in the
yes, but you know, like, he put his weight, but I can see what you mean. It's definitely seemed like, especially because, you know, it's a UWFI against New Japan. It was a new Liger was working the New Japan style week in, week out, whereas Sano wasn't. Obviously, he had experience, but I definitely felt like it was based around Liger, with Sano kind of bouncing off Liger and adding into the match. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. So, at the end of this match, I mean, for all that we have moaned and are moaning and are about to moan about the booking of this feud vis-a-vis the relative kayfabe power levels of the two forces, Sano does get a decisive win here. Does his jumping back kick, release dragon suplex, and wins, gets the 1-2-3 tiger suplex, bridging one. And that gets him the win.
Do you think that maybe they were happy, that they were, you know, New Japan was happier to give UWFI the win in this match precisely because of the way it was presented and the fact that it wasn't this kind of challenge to strong style? It wasn't shoot style being able to get one over.
That's a really good point. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that before.
More of a hybrid match.
I definitely think as well, obviously Sano, you know, he's worked in New Japan, he would have some mates. Like, he is a more relatable figure for New Japan than, say, for example, Takeda or Takayama or something like that. Like, people who weren't established. Like, he had worked for New Japan in the past. I think they maybe felt that this was more of a returning, you know, superstar Naoki Sano, as opposed to UWFI invader Naoki Sano. I definitely feel like they were far more comfortable giving him a bit more of the rub, just because he was a New Japan guy at one point. He could work the style, and it wasn't going to be, you know, shoot style overtaking.
Yeah, that's another great point actually. So with that in mind, that takes us to all. So things are level pegging. You know, it's all to play for in this 8-match series.
Yeah.
And no tap out, no submission. I was fucking delighted about it.
And now things are about to take something of a turn.
Oh, for fuck's sake, I just see what
Right, so the next match.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to welcome you back to the ongoing saga of our boy, our very own, possibly the world's least fortunate wrestler, the wrestler that probably gives the least amount of forethought to just about anything he does, bless him.
Yeah.
Yay!
But it's your wrestling lads.
For those who would like to sort of go back and really get a bit more background about the kind of the human manifestation of a mistake that is Yoji Anjo. That was a bit harsh. I mean, I wasn't going to say you could have been aborted or anything. So if you'd like to hear about how Yoji Anjo was nearly aborted, go and listen to our previous episode in which he decides to travel to Hicks and Gracie's gym and challenge him to a fight. You can check that out in the previous episode, but here he is now. Hey, it's plain sailing for the Jews now, right?
Is that manna? No, it's not manna, it's fucking Ricky Choshu hovering over the horizon with a look of murder in his eye and a song in his heart.
Can I repeat my favourite phrase I've ever written down in my life?
Yes.
About this match, about just in general, just like through school and university. I've never written anything that I found as funny as this. Choshu looks aggrieved, as if he had booked annual leave so that he and his wife could go for a romantic dinner, but it's been rejected because Yoji Anjo needs a match.
Hey, Yoji, could you stay behind and work another half an hour? Oh, boss, I've counted here for 12 already. I'll get a takeaway pizza for
one
us.
One topping.
I know you've worked a 66-hour week at Yoji, but can I put you down for some overtime on Sunday?
I love that, like, we were talking about our different life experiences. You two have, like, those are clearly rooted in, like, things you guys have experienced in real life.
All too fucking real. Like,
basically for...
God, yes.
You know, I recently started a new job, but for about 4 years before that, you know, the biggest problem I had at work was, am I going to change out of my pyjamas to write this section of my PhD thesis or not?
Oh, you lucky bastard.
So,
fucking southerners.
I'm from the Midlands, you cheeky shit.
It's the same fucking thing.
Be that as it
may. You have a sign that says the north this way.
George, I was going to say, George, you have to remember that
David, is true.
I'm from the fucking south. Like,
okay, so this match, is.
So,
there's a bit of an extra frisson. I don't know if we've mentioned this. It is Booker versus Booker, but only one Booker's booking.
How will this turn
out? Well, before we find out how this turned out, we've got a little video which you can see before the match on the New Japan World video of this. And Inoki-san is talking to the commentator, and beside him is his longtime rival from the 80s, Masa Saito, who might be best known to our American listeners for doing 2 years bird in the US, for teaming up with Ken Patera in the very noble cause of chucking a boulder through the window of a Mackie D's because he was hungry.
Like, it's one of the all-time legendary pro wrestlers have been just terribly behaved human stories.
You may also know him from New Year's Dash, where he teamed up with Team 2000 and Cheeseburger against the
Bullet
Club.
That's Hiro Saito. You
of
get this Saito mixed up.
Ah.
No, Masa Saito's really not very well at the moment, actually.
Oh, is that the one that Lesnar went to visit?
Yeah, because Lesnar, the reason BCD used to happen is because Brock Lesnar wanted to go to Japan because he was friends with Masa Saito and he heard he wasn't very well. So, you know, thoughts go out to him. He was a fantastic wrestler at his time. These two...
I was just going to say, don't worry about that, David, because I always get the Saitos mixed up as well. Like, and pretty much a lot of people I know that are really into wrestling have real trouble
Saito's like Jones in Japan.
It's a pretty common mistake.
But these two have, Inoki and Saito, chatting together at the commentary desk, clearly have patched things up since the Gamry Jima Island death match. And while we're here, can I just say, I would like to place a moratorium on us ever reviewing the Gamry Jima Island death match. Because I know, David, you would be all over that monstrosity.
I was literally just about to say we're going to review it. Literally just about to say. Although one thing I feel that you are missing out the most important member of the commentary team, Mr. Shaky Handsman Banzai.
Fuck me, I remember that.
Oh, that guy. Oh man, just hovering there, like a particularly kind of nefarious dragonfly. But can I just point out that you know that death match, right? I honestly feel like that death match is kind of the equivalent of watching like a 7-hour Bellator film. Like, it's like you're watching and all of a sudden you're like, I've been watching this horse have it stable cleaned for like 40 minutes, and I don't want to get up and leave the cinema because, like, I mean, it is really good, and I understand that it's great art. But, like, I am a bit drunk, and, like, I kind of want to be out of here
You can imagine,
like,
fucking Bellator in the ring, about to wrestle. He's feuding with Chris Jericho in the lead-up to Mania. And the ring announcer, she does her announcement, and he takes issue with it and just goes, "It's Satan Tango." That is easily the most obscure joke I've ever made, possibly in my life.
Oh. So I'd just like to give a shout out to our 500 new listeners.
Hey, I mentioned fucking Kurt Ladder.
Yeah, before
you arrived. Tesco bit, right? So, and they love leaving and renting. So, you know.
Oh, that's That's true. That combined with our numerous references to Irish republicanism should be enough to alienate enough people already. So we'd probably have 1,000 listeners if it wasn't for this shit. But...
I think we should be more concerned with actually elaborating what the Gamera Jima Island death match was for people unaware of that. So basically...
The whole thing is on YouTube. Yeah. Someone uploaded the whole thing. It's like an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And the rest, yeah. Enoki and Saito fought on an island for upwards of 2 hours. It's...
I've seen highlights. I've seen it all.
Where are you ranked?
It was absolutely horrendous. Like I wasn't wrecked. I was I was filming a tax return. I think it was like a couple of years ago because I was like technically self-employed for a little bit during that time. So I had to do the tax return for that period. And I was, you just put something on in the background.
Well, I'm crazy. This is the sort of thing I would do when I'm tidying up the house or like doing like washings.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So to the match.
Tangent number 18.
To the match. My first note on this just says fucking heat for Anjo. Choshu is solid as fuck. And that really, we could just skip on to the next match because that really is the story of it. This is, I think, on a show and indeed a feud characterized by New Japan wrestlers making UWFI guys look a bit rubbish. This one takes the cake. Really, this is.
I'll handle play by play on this one, right? Because I have notes, right? So my play-by-play for this was Andrew's zebra tights are incredible. No selling abounds. Mm. Headbutts abound. Choshu is 44. Andrew is 25. You can tell. Choshu beats the piss out of Andrew and has no concern for his well-being. Post-match press conference, Choshu simply does not want to be there. That's
done.
Yeah,
fair enough.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important for us to point out that that might seem like an exaggeration.
It's not.
Just said,
but it's really fucking not. Because this actually stands... I think in the all-time great no-selling performances, and we're not talking about, Undertaker-style no-selling here. We're not talking about the impenetrable, immovable object, rather, monster-type no-selling. We're talking about just straight-up... bitchy, unprofessional, no selling to prove a point, right? This is, I'd say, second tier with maybe the likes of Brody Luger in the cage at the very, very top. But this is really.
If I ran the Louvre, right, the art gallery in the Louvre, I would have a room dedicated to two screens with this and that Junaki Yama-Leona match just playing on a constant loop forever because. Yeah. It is some Renaissance level art going on.
Sorry, Crown of Louis XV. Sorry, Winged Victory of Samothrace. You're out on your ass. We gotta get these salty old men beating the fuck out of young boys. Jesus Christ. Yeah, what I've got, it says Anjo basically starts, does some knees and forearms. He may as well have not bothered. Choshu sells fuck all and even manages to no-sell Anjo shooting for a takedown by simply moving out of the way. Now, the thing is, I think we have to sort of maybe get a glimpse into the twisted mind of one Richard Choshu. why does he do this? Firstly, he's being a bit of a cunt. Secondly, the crowd... really, really, really wants him to beat the piss out of Anjo, which is what delivers them. Because let's not forget, we talked about this in episode 4, Yoji Anjo literally let down the entire country. He is one of the most hated men in Japan at this moment. And
he is the Tim Henman of feudal.
Hell, like huge reactions when Choshu just starts forearming the shit out of Anjo in the corner. They really want to see him just get destroyed. I mean, Choshu, he sells a bit when Anjo gets him in a knee bar and he tries a tendon hold countering the Scorpion Deathlock. But, I mean, fucking hell. Like, I think I've got nothing apart from, let's just cut to the finish. Jesus. Like, backdrop and a really hard lariat.
Yeah.
And a Scorpion Deathlock to finish. I mean, You'll know that as Sting's finishing move, and also the sharpshooter as Bret Hart called it. It's the same move. Choshu was actually the one who, I believe he's the one who invented it. And it is known as the Sasori Katame in Japan, which literally means scorpion hold. Anjo taps out.
Yeah.
Can you fucking believe it? Do you mean to tell me that a UWF five wrestler? Yeah.
If online betting was legalized in 1995 for the Tokyo Dome show, I'd have been putting all fucking submission finishes down for my bets, because overall, even more so than Choshu being an absolute wank in this match, right? The fucking tap out nonsense. I will never get over it. Just, I mean, fuck off. I mean, see, just fuck off.
I think it begins to, when it's sort of so accumulative, it begins to become kind of really obvious what the game is here. And I remember sort of, I think maybe I'd say when I was maybe just first getting into Japanese wrestling and finding out about it, and this feud was kind of bigged up as a really big deal before I'd really watched a lot of the matches. And I remember you'd read about sort of retrospectives on it in sort of the magazines that kept kayfabe and stuff, like, you know, the kind of after mags and things that you'd get shipped over to shops and things like that. And they'd kind of retrospectively mentioned things about how, you know, this was this great feud and it was like it did great business. And in my head, I always thought, God, this must have been so hotly contested. And, like, you know, so and it, at this point in the show, it really isn't. And I think that it really does sort of, especially at this point, this is the peak of it. It really is like sort of popping a balloon, you know, that you're just dissipating all that that tension that could have been built up. And at this point, I begin to kind of think, well, you can see how this is going. You know, it seems very obvious. So at this point, I was kind of thinking, I need something to save this show.
Yeah,
again,
well,
you know?
you're not going to get it. So, yeah, no, also significantly God, no. Is that Anjo taps to a hold, which is not used in UWFI because they didn't use holds that you wouldn't be able to do in a shoot. And that's going to be important later for reasons that we're going to get into. At this press conference, as you said, David, like, Choshu's, he's thinking, okay, God, I don't want to be here. You see him wiping himself down after the match. I'm not sure why. He didn't break a sweat. It was like quite a lethargic 5 minutes. And like what you said about this being a waste, really. Basically, Choshu was not only quite cool, really, in the way that he just buried this poor bloke. He was also quite lazy doing it, because now Choshu is known for, his wrestling is like much more like punch kick sort of stuff. Like, it's quite fast paced. He was always known for the fast pace of his matches.
There's actually in Japan, there's actually a name that Japanese fans use for that. He was actually noted by Japanese fans as heralding a new kind of style that was a lot more sort of pared down, but also quite fast paced. Yeah. And the perfect examples of that would be the great matches that you have with Fujinami.
Absolutely. They call it Choshuism. And when he went to All Japan, you know, he really heralded a sea change in the way that matches will work there. The pace really ramped up from what it had been. When you think of Choshuism, you think of punches, kicks, fast pace. But Choshu was fully capable of doing a good shoot star match. He actually wrestled on the South Korea's Olympic wrestling team at the 1972 Munich Olympics. So he knew his amateur stuff.
The guy knows his way.
He could really do that, but absolutely. Instead he chose not to. And there was a great point that when we first recorded this, David made, and I'll just recount this conversation if I may. David just asked me, how long did that match last? And I said, about 4.5 minutes, I guess. And David was like, so you mean to tell me that Choshu has booked himself to beat Yoji Anjo in a shorter amount of time than it took Hicks and Gracie? And it's true, he did. The sheer fucking nerve of the man.
Yeah. Look at me in the eyes, both of you, because we were on webcam. If you had the opportunity to rattle Yoji Anjo like this, you'd have fucking done it in less time than Hexen as well.
Yes. that is true. Like, Choshu, like, the thing is, I really want to, I think we will do later, is there's another match of his coming up in this feud, and, you know, we have been a bit down on Choshu. So like, I think we are gonna like do some of his like real classic stuff at some time in the future, just to like wash the taste of this hell out of our mouth. Speaking of hell, our next match. Kensuke Sasaki, back from episode 3, along with his greasy, greasy mullet, representing New Japan Pro Wrestling versus Masahito Kakehara of UWFI. Now, before we go into this match, we should note Sasaki was a protege of one Riki Choshu, and his senpai...
Sorry, George. I'm sorry, but I thought you were going to say Sasaki was a Protestant. I kind of thought that's what you'd said, so I kind of, sorry.
I did think it was weird, because like, his entrance theme is a power metal version of King Billy.
have you not seen that, is it, I can't remember what show it is in New Japan World, where all the rosters sing the Lord's Prayer. And then, like, near the end, all of them just sit down, apart from Sasuke, and he continues for an extra verse.
No.
What is this that, fucking Cliff incredible. Richard Christmas number one shit?
No, I fucking wish it was. I'm just making that up.
Oh, but damn it.
He's a Protestant. He's a total
The thing
Protestant.
Is, I believe it, because I've seen a video of the 80s All Japan roster reenacting scenes from Rose of Versailles.
Yeah.
And, like, fucking Kawada in drag. Anyway.
He doesn't have the teeth for drag. That's all I'm saying.
Now, at the outset, before we get into this match, I would like to make clear that Riki Choshu clearly taught him things about selling for UWFI guys, which is very nicely illustrated at the start of this match when Kakehara does about a billion palm strikes with very little effect and then falls on his ass backing away when Sasaki moves towards him. It's like, you've bumped for nothing. You've bumped for thin air.
Yeah.
And then Sasaki's first actual strike knocks him down. So from that you can see, like, oh, right, it's another one of those, maybe not as egregious a domination as Choshu was just affected, but you know, it's of that ilk.
Absolutely. What one of the things that I was gonna that I took down in my notes, and I think maybe I might have taken these notes when I was maybe having a slightly low mood, I kind of, when I was watching it at the time, and I might need to rewatch this, I like a lot of the Kakehara that I've seen, but in this match, I felt like he was kind of cosplaying or coming across as kind of a poor man's Tamura in place. I don't know if that's a fair comment, but I kind of felt like there were spots in there, and there were those kind of palm strike things and some of the other strikes that he did, where I kind of felt like he didn't seem entirely sure about when was a good time to time them, when was a good time to sort of, you know, bring them heavily and maybe leave off them. I kind of felt like some of the stuff he did kind of took me out of this, but I don't know if that's something that you guys...
I think it is a fair point. Like, I think part of the problem is that that really does affect this match, because when he is, like, quite unsure when to time his palm strikes on offense, he doesn't get a lot of fucking opportunities to actually be on offense. So that really doesn't help. Sasaki, at least, like, apart, you know, unlike Choshu, like, actually, like, does some stuff. There's a really like amazingly good deadlift power slam, which he does countering a kick, and a really big pop for the power strangle, which was his submission finish. Again, making the point that on this show, pro wrestling submissions are more over than shoot style ones. If you look later in the match at Kakehara locks in a triangle choke. And the crowd pops, but only when it looks like Sasaki's about to do the fucking powerbomb counter that every single triangle choke in the history of pro wrestling, except when done by the best pure striker in the WWE, gets countered with.
trademark, yeah. I think maybe that... Sorry, I jump in here again, David. I know I'm hogging the conversation a bit, but it's just come into my head. I think maybe this has something to do with the fact that... If this was taking place now, and someone goes and locks in the triangle, most people that have watched pro wrestling know what a triangle is, right? Most people probably that are watching wrestling have maybe seen a little bit of MMA or maybe understand what's happening there. Here, as you say, it's only really when it looks as if there's a real bit of peril happening in the move that the crowd begins to react. When it first gets locked in, I'm not entirely sure that all of the New Japan fans are down with understanding some of these submissions. And that's something we touched on in the previous podcast as well.
Yeah. This to his credit, Sasaki does get down and dirty with the mat work. If not, he's not exactly inclined to sell it. I don't think Choshu left his feet in the previous match. But yeah, as if to underline it, at one point Sasaki just drops onto his back and lets Kakehara get the dominant position on him. And at other points, he lets him out of submissions and stands him back up. It's just a bit of a dick move, really. Like, as if it's like a fucking bear playing with his food.
Yeah, definitely. Like, there's definitely another sense in this match, I think, of shoot style being made to look a little bit silly.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
You know, it's...
One thing I'd like to note about this match, I lost my notes for it. However, I can remember that I really enjoy Kensuke Sasaki's Krypton Factor tights. I thought they were an outstanding highlight of the match, and literally the only thing I could be asked to remember.
Brilliant.
That's... Oh, Jesus. I mean, the... Yeah, the Sasaki also no sells an attempted takedown, just falls on top of Kakehara.
I love that because at first I thought it was maybe kind of just a botch or a bit of a miscommunication, but I'm pretty sure he was just being an arsehole.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. You know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of, you know, that episode of Futurama where Bender becomes an ultimate robot fighter. And he fights this 50-foot tall robot called Destructor, and it turns out Destructor's being controlled by a man underneath the ring. And so Leela goes and knocks the guy out, and Bender's like, yeah, and then Destructor just falls on him, and the ref counts 1, 2, 3. Like,
very much from my wife's philosophy on wrestling, and that my wife believes that nobody can beat the Big Show. And if this was a real sport, the Big Show would literally just sit on him and win every single match and reign as champion for about 15
years. She is right. His finisher would just be a side headlock takeover.
Yeah. Like, she's not necessarily wrong there. You know, like, there's a reason that they have weight classes in real fighting. Like, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
Like, put it
I did
way.
Like the suggestion of WWE setting up 405 Live.
They should do that, man. We've been through this already, but when we start our fat blob fighting promotion in Moscow under the auspices of our dear leader Vladimir Putin, everything's gonna be okay. We're gonna fix wrestling.
Yeah.
Make wrestling great again.
make wrestlers fat again.
Kevin Owens isn't
serious.
Fat. He's not fat.
No. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. There is a type of fat which is intimidating.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
And then there's a type of fat which is just like normal guy fat, right?
Yeah.
Like, has a belly, right? Yeah. You know? Like.
Yeah, because Kevin Owens is like picked last at football fat, right?
Yeah.
Before maybe the people on crutches and the people who are like blind.
Yeah.
And then you have people who are like, you know, have to be winched out of their house. That's the fat people that I like. So Kevin Owens isn't fat.
You just
people have Channel 5 documentaries about them. That's how I want fighting in Ryzen, right?
Yeah,
you just know there's absolutely a fucking like DeviantArt Photoshop page called Make Wrestlers Fat Again. It's just loads of fucking like feederist morphs. That definitely exists, I'm sure of it.
Have you ever seen the DeviantArt of Big Daddy V?
Oh
my god, there's a bit of DeviantArt of Big Daddy V on before the Elimination Chamber match. When I was at him, Undertaker, Batista, the one where Undertaker and Batista ran through everybody in like 5 minutes and he just battered her. Well, there's a deviant art of Big Daddy V inside the Elimination Chamber, and it's like his head and arms and flabs sticking out from out of the bar. It is enveloped the entire chamber.
Oh my god!
I wish I could find it so much.
It's like, I'm sorry, Ash, for the new logo. Love the new logo, but like, we found a replacement.
We should point out at this juncture that when we talk about bigger people in wrestling, we are not taking
no, not at all.
Like we seriously want there to be a diversity of bodies in wrestling because that's what we like.
Yeah, I think we've been over this before. It's like Chris Hero's since he started eating like a load of pies again, like he's fucking amazing. And similarly, having someone like Nia Jax in the women's division in WWE really makes for not just like a good role model, but also, you know, you can do very different things with the size differential. Her matches are always entertaining because of that.
Yeah, I mean,
I voted for Ryo Tahama versus Okabe Ashi. That was my number 5 in my match of the year list for Voices of Wrestling.
That's a great match.
The blueprint for all Fat Blob matches.
It really should be. But I mean, you know, as I've said, like, you know, Nia Jax's matches are great because of the size differential. Not every size differential match is great, which brings us back to Kensuke Sasaki versus Masahito Kakahara. Sasaki, as we've said, he really does dominate, doesn't give Kakahara much. He does at least turtle up at palm strikes, and he has the grace to look like a sleeper hold might be hurting him a bit. My favourite part is when his nose gets bloodied off of palm strikes. Like, Jesus Christ, the most selling in this match is involuntary. He's like, his own body is rebelling against him. His blood is just like, I'm going to get this angle over if you're not, mate.
He just pashed
by. Oh, he really did. It was fucking horrible. There's a pretty good out of nowhere finish in this. Kakahara rolls an attempted German suplex into a grapevine ankle lock, and then he transitions it into a heel hook. Sasaki does fucking sell it, and then he submits. The bell only rings after the ref gets him to let go of the hold, which is all a bit confusing, and probably some sort of like the ref being paid off by Riki Choshu to intentionally make UWFI's wins more underwhelming than the New Japan's.
But George, pray tell, did Sasaki tap? Do you know if he tapped at all? Because I don't think he did. It's just a little inkling in the back of my mind that Sasaki did not tap out. But in fact, and not even an inkling, I fucking know he didn't, right? He didn't even say that he quit or that he submit or anything. Literally, the referee just went, right, game's a bogey. That's it.
He didn't even say that he quit.
He just fucking rang.
He didn't
the
even do the fucking Bob Backlund, like, rah! Yeah, he quits from the I quit match with Bret Hart. So that ties it up as 3-3, but really it's one of these things where in this we're now midway through a run of matches with like big New Japan heavyweights against smaller UWFI shoot style workers. And this really is a story of the big guys are going over, and you know, even if they don't go over as in this match, they're still going over because they've basically made Kakahara's win, it's put over his submission skills in a sense, but it's because, you know, he didn't have to work Sasaki over much to get the tap, not the tap out, to get the submission, but he's also like made it seem to be a bit of a fluke, you know.
Yeah, I would equate this to Nuts in the Robot Wars semi-final against Carbide, where Carbide had destroyed everything in its path, and Nuts, I believe, I can't remember what happened, but basically Carbide's blade stopped working. I think he maybe hit Nuts too much and it just stopped working, and Nuts took the advantage and gave him an oily nose.
It's like the robot equivalent of like Homer Simpson versus Boxcar Bob. Just like, just wave him to wear himself out.
Came up from the box, cars, eh?
He's a hungry young robot.
That's what New Japan were saying about UWFI. Yeah.
So, also I noticed at the end of this match, Takeyama's wearing a Jack Daniels logo parody shirt 20 years before every indie wrestler started doing it.
I was thinking that. I'd like one of those shirts, actually. They're pretty
great. Much like old 90s pro merch, which you know they don't make anymore. And like, I saw a guy at York Hall at the weekend for the Rev Pro show wearing this t-shirt, which was like a cartoon Misawa giving a forearm to a cartoon Kawada, and I nearly ripped it off him and disappeared into the night.
I think the other thing that I was going to mention here is that in terms of what we've been looking at so far, we've been looking at really two matches in a row that kind of have this one isn't quite as extreme as the Joshi one, but we've both been looking at two matches where there's kind of bigger guys, big powerful guys, kind of hammering away, smaller, relatively pluckier guys. Okay, if you think that that's about to, that we're going to have a gear shift before the main event, well, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but we are going to have another match next.
Jesus Christ! Yeah, it's so fucking rage inducing. Like it's ridiculous, which is why I'd like to take this juncture to sort of remind everyone that there were some great things in 90s New Japan, and that, you know, Kensuke Sasaki is not a man to be reviled. So I'm going to...
Especially if you're a dojo trainee.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah, okay, he did kill a man, but apart from that, allegedly...
Allegedly. Let's get that
definition is like a volley of allegedly.
I'm pretty sure we don't even have to do allegedly on that one, do we?
I know, but just to make sure.
Just to cover us, or at least to cover mine.
Because you might not sue us, but you might get us in for a grappling session, and I'm not fucking up for that.
A story about Kensuke Sasaki, which I would like to tell. Kensuke Sasaki is a pretty well-known guy in Japan, and his wife was a wrestler called Akira Hokuto. Who is, for my money, one of the greatest wrestlers of all time, not just in terms of women's wrestling, but just in terms of wrestlers of any gender. Like
one of mine too. We'll do an entire episode on the.
Yeah, absolutely. Like she's fantastic. But the circumstances of their getting together were like somewhat bizarre. They got engaged the day after meeting each other in Pyongyang.
Who doesn't?
Exactly. And they were there.
They were there because Antonio Inoki had he was staging a wrestling show in Pyongyang, featuring New Japan wrestlers and WCW wrestlers. Part of it was to honor Riki Dozan, his mentor and, you know, the father of wrestling in Japan, who, as I think I might have mentioned previously, spoilers for my upcoming novel, which is definitely getting finished this year, I swear to God, Riki Dozan was actually born in North Korea. And so this was Inoki's way of honouring him. I also recently found out, I recently finished North Korea Past and Future by Victor Cha, which is a history book about North Korea. And apparently Inoki also got paid $15 million by the Korean Workers' Party. So that might have had something to do with the fact that he was willing to stage the show. But be that as it may.
It's not as if the Korean Workers' Party has anything else they need to spend money on.
No, not in 1995. Like, everything was fucking hunky-dory. But
like, I don't know.
Feeding
people.
Yeah, like, I mean, we could shore up the public distribution system, but nah.
Didn't they try to pay Hogan to
go? Oh, yeah, but Hogan had no.
I'm pretty sure
he was like,
they invited Hogan and Hogan turned it down because it's a scam.
Yeah, Hogan didn't want to go to North Korea much, but I think more than that, did not want to put Inoki over. So,
he's been happy to make promos about the great leader, but not put anybody over.
Madness. But probably the weirdest part of this stuff was that Sasaki and Hokuto got together, and apparently so got together a day after meeting each other. You can probably fill in the blanks, but I'm going to do it for you. Apparently, kept up everyone else on their floor at the hotel they were staying at in Pyongyang with very, very, very loud shagging. I actually imagine that, I think fucking Kensuke Sasaki would be, I think you'd shag him for the same reasons that you'd book him. You know, you wanted to fuck Kenta Kobashi, but he's not available. So you want something that's like shagging Kenta Kobashi, but not quite as good.
Oh, well, I mean, I do remember. I remember reading an Observer from around about the time. I do seem to remember the Metal Slug gave the sex tape 4.75 stars. So, but unfortunately, it wasn't in the Tokyo Dome, so I couldn't give it the full 5.
Of course, this was in the halcyon mists of time, in a time before Trump and before 6 stars.
Yeah.
5 stars.
We didn't know we were born. Yeah. I barely was, to be fair.
No.
I mean, the thing actually, this is quite sweet. They actually adopted each other's finishing moves after getting together. Hokuto started doing the power strangle, and Sasaki started doing Hokuto's finish, the Northern Lights bomb. Hokuto did both moves better than him.
Definitely.
I don't know why, but when you said this is quite sweet, I expected you to say Kensuke Sasaki killed a man.
Allegedly, David. Allegedly, we've been
allegedly.
Yeah.
I know, like, those are legitimate businessmen that run Japanese wrestling.
Yeah, exactly. You know, moving on before those legitimate businessmen do some legitimate business on us. The next match.
So far in this episode, we've annoyed unreconstructed anti-revisionist Marxist-Leninists. And
Ian Duncan
also,
Smith.
Ian Duncan Smith, Protestants and loyalists in general.
And poorly Republicans as well.
and Republicans by appropriating their culture. I think that's a pretty good hit list so far.
I think so. Let's see who else we can offend before the end.
Probably like large people.
Oh no, well. I will defend us on this. We put over fat people.
Yeah,
that's true.
We put them over big. So next match. Speaking of fat people, here we go. Here's one of the best fat men of all time in wrestling. Let's have a talk about him. So our next match, with the score tied at 3-3, is Shinya Hashimoto representing New Japan versus Tatsuo Nakano of UWFI. Now, Daniel, tell everyone how much you love Shinya Hashimoto.
Oh, God. I love Hash so much. And I think the kind of the reason that I love him so much is because when I first got into Japanese wrestling, you obviously heard the four pillars spoken of in the most hallowed tones, and rightly so. But really, I remember kind of knowing that New Japan was a thing, and only kind of later on hearing about the Three Musketeers, Chono, Hashimoto, and Muto, and kind of being a little bit slow to check them out when I was younger, just because I kind of thought, well, they're never going to be able to compare with Japan and King's Road being, this ultra dramatic kind of incredibly, intense style. And I remember being kind of disappointed when I first checked out, Chono and Muto, who to this day are two guys that I think, other than a couple of periods in their career, are for me quite overrated wrestlers. And it was Hashimoto, the guy who looked really the least, athletic, the guy who famously smoked like a fucking chimney, drank a lot. There's hilarious.
A man's man.
A man's man. There's hilarious footage of Vader, of all fucking people, on YouTube saying that, Hashimoto, he didn't respect Hashimoto because he smoked cigarettes and he wasn't in shape.
I mean, but that's Vader saying that.
Vader, man. Of all people, Vader should have been able to see a guy who was big but was really athletic.
Well, Vader's got previous for this because he was having a go at Will Ospreay and Ricochet for, like, doing too many flips in the match. This was a 400-pound man who did a moonsault in the fucking early 90s.
Yeah. Although, I kind of tend to come down more on Vader's side of the argument.
Oh, I know
one,
you
but,
do.
But I'm a prick.
You've got a little Hashimoto in your house, haven't you?
Oh, I do, because George and Sarah, who is George's partner, and who I believe is going to be on an episode.
Oh yes, she is at some time in the future.
They very kindly ordered me for my birthday these three little kind of mini figurines of three of my favorite wrestlers. So they got Tenryu, Hashimoto, and Kawada, which was just lovely. And yes,
I'd like to put in a thing in a moment because I feel like I need to apologize to yourself because I too was going to send you a present, right? And I actually had this legitimate.
Oh, I forgot about this.
Yeah, I had this legitimate question I asked my wife, where I said, "Can you send cans in the post?" And she's like, "I don't think so. I mean, I've sent one can. I've sent one can before. I usually, when you sing a Secret Santa, I'd always put a can of Iron Brew and a bottle of Buckfast in. So it's feasible. But six cans of Stella." And then I was like, "Can I just order like an Asda delivery just to turn up at his door?" Like, "No, man, you need to book a time." And I'm like, "I don't know what the fuck he's gonna be in." So yeah, you have some cans on your way at some point in the next 6 months. But I'll figure out the logistics soon. So I want to profusely apologise. I'm not sending you some cans in the post.
We look after each other here on the Puri Puri podcast. You can actually go on this. There's an eBay store. I think it's called Sumo Shop or something like that. You can find it quite easily. And the guy who runs it is a fellow in Chiba, home of K-Dojo. And he's got the most amazing collection of classic Japanese wrestling figurines, the figurines of classic Japanese wrestlers. There's over 100 different wrestlers you can get types of. And you can get like Inoki in a suit, Inoki out of a suit, Barbara in a robe, Barbara out of a robe. I got Daniel Hashimoto in his fucking entrance robe. I thought that was cooler than him just in parachute pants, and
it definitely is, and it's definitely the best. Like,
not only that, he's got the world's biggest collection of Big Mouth Loud merch you can buy. Remember Big Mouth Loud? Oh, I remember.
Oh yes, we will be doing a show on Big Mouth Loud as well.
Yeah, we definitely should. But yeah, so
I'll just circle back to Hashimoto. So for those of you who aren't acquainted with Shinya Hashimoto, he is one of the Three Musketeers, which were around at the same time as the Four Pillars. And as I say, Chono and Muto, and we'll talk about Muto in a moment, two guys that have always disappointed me a little bit, I think, for a lot of their runs in wrestling. But Hashimoto is the shining star, the absolute embodiment of everything that I actually like about the New Japan main event style during that time. This is a guy who, as I said, he looks like a bigger guy, big, huge-chested guy, and really sort of, you know, looks like he wouldn't be in great shape. But my God, does this man know how to structure a amazing main event. I think, for my money, this guy has one of the best auras in wrestling. When he walks down that ramp, you know it's fucking on. He's got the I think it's the fighting spirit on his, on his headband. Yeah, it's the toucan headband. He's got his big silky kind of kimono-y style, almost like a gi kind of with a kimono style thing as he comes out. This guy really, he was often talked about in the same breath as Kawada, who he's spoken about a lot in All Japan. It's another one of my all-time favorites. A similar kind of guy in some senses, known for very stiff strikes, especially kick and forearms, but really a really stiff kicker. A guy, an underrated guy on the mat as well. You watch some matches that he has with guys like Hiroshi Hase, things like that. The guy can work a period on the mat as well before he starts throwing big bombs. But crucially, for me, this is a guy that knows exactly when to ramp things up and to take things to that real sort of heavy next level of a match where it just everything's on the line and crazy strikes are being thrown. And there's always this little bit of an element to me of the chaotic kind of in Hashimoto matches as well, which I really like. It's a nice alternative to the King's Road style where you feel like even though you're on the edge of your seat, it's all been kind of mapped out very methodically.
Yeah, I do know. I do know what you mean with that. I mean, what I would say, and we'll talk about this getting into the match, is Hashimoto was certainly, I think, the best wrestler of the Three Musketeers. One thing that...
Oh, it's not even close.
And this is by no means his fault, but one thing that counts against him is that he had basically taken on, and we talked about this earlier in episode 4, and that Antonio Inoki was the guy who would defend the company and the honour of... you know, the strong style pro wrestling against the shooters coming in. After Inoki, you know, semi-retired, having gone into his high-level politics and embezzlement career, Hashimoto sort of got put into the Inoki role because he had this aura of being, as you said, the most legit, you know, an aura of legitness, as Walter Benjamin would say. And so he often got put in, you know, matches against shooters, a lot of whom... and as we've said before with people like Willem Ruska and Willie Williams, couldn't really work.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was a great wrestler, but, like, he couldn't carry a guy who literally didn't know what they were doing. So often these big matches he had, these big, what they were called different style fights, weren't very good, and in the vast majority of cases, it is his opponent's fault. However, here, Tatsuo Nakano of Utah UFI is an experienced shoot-style wrestler. His match with Masakatsu Funaki in Utah UFI Reborn in 1989 is probably my favourite shoot-style match ever.
Right, okay.
It's well worth a watch. It's only 9 minutes long as well. Yeah. But they pack so much energy and excitement into that.
Yeah, I've seen the match. It is a fantastic match. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, definitely.
So I saw this on paper, and I thought, okay, this will be good. And it's certainly better than... the last two matches.
Yeah.
I also like to note that there's a decent mullet on Nakano, if not as angular and as Sasaki's.
No. It's a deceptively good mullet.
Yeah. One thing this really, and again, this brings home the point about the size differential, is that Nakano's a solidly built guy, but he looks absolutely tiny compared to Hashimoto.
Yeah.
And there is a nice story being told in that Nakano executes your favourite technique, Daniel, which is the leg kicks.
Yeah.
His strategy in the initial going revolves around that.
Yeah.
And I love leg kicks.
Yeah.
If you look at the Takada Vader matches that happened in UWFI as well, that's a great way to play off the size differential, you know, trying to be sort of like a little annoying gnat, just chipping away at your opponent until they lunge in and make a mistake. I thought the psychology of that was really good.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm always a big fan of when leg kicks are used to sort of fell the big beast as well.
Yes.
Because, I mean, let's be honest, this is something which is legit within martial martial arts. Maybe not within the size differential.
No.
You know, the first...
It is in rising, mate.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, the first time that Nak Moyes fought in the West against famous kickboxers, there's a particularly famous fight. I can never pronounce the Thai names properly, so I'm not even going to try. But it's a great old Nak Moy against Rick Rufus, the famous
kickboxer. Former Charlton Athletic centre-back.
Yes, against Richard Rufus, former England B team.
Linvoy Primus is his second.
Yeah. There's a wonderful video on there. If anyone wants to check this out, search for Lawrence Kenshin. He does strike breakdowns on YouTube, and it details how Nak Moyes really just confounded kickboxers with their leg kicks when they first started coming over. So it is something which isn't just a narrative device. It does have an air of legitness to it as well.
Yeah, and particularly over in Japan, as we mentioned in episode 4, it was something that Inoki had used to great effect in his famous fiasco against Muhammad Ali.
Of course.
One spot I really liked early on in this match was there's a great spot where Nakano tries to give Hashimoto a German suplex, and Hashimoto tries to escape the waist lock. And he's at this for about a good 30 seconds, and then Nakano finally manages to execute the throw. I thought that was really well done in contrast to basically what you get nowadays. Actually, there was a great match recently, which you can watch on Stardom World, actually, which was Io Shirai versus Viper.
Oh, I've still not seen that match yet. I'm going to watch it, though.
It's fantastic. And there's another thing, like, great size differential. You have a smaller woman against a much bigger woman.
Yeah.
And it makes some really great action. And there's spots in this match where the psychology of it was built towards Io trying to give Viper a German suplex.
Sure, yeah.
And she actually does it, which is impressive because Viper's about 220 and Io's 5'1" and like weighs fuck all.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, she's really, really strong woman. But when she tried the Germans and failed, she basically try it once and they go, "Oh, my back, ah, shit." And then go on to do something else. Whereas here, there's a sense of like, there's a real struggle. And I really like that. It stands out as something very different to what you would see nowadays in sort of German suplex related transitions.
Absolutely. I think with this match, as we've just mentioned, there are very interesting things there stylistically and in the way that it's set up. In the way that it's set out, rather, in terms of the narrative that they're trying to drive through the use of the kicks and certain of the suplexes and things like that. I would say, though, however, that for me, as someone who is a massive Hashimoto mark, it is disappointing, I think, this match.
Yeah.
It's fair to say. And I guess, I suppose what I was wondering was, there are certain times when it's difficult to pinpoint exactly what it is that's disappointing about a match, because I didn't expect this to be necessarily an all-time classic. I did maybe expect it to, it sounds weird given how we've just described it, but have a little bit more intensity in the stretch at the end.
Yeah, I think so. Part of it's the weird crowd reaction as well, as I've said. Like, there's a bit where Nakano, he's going for a rear naked choke and they may as well just be circling each other.
Yeah, it's odd.
Like, and it's not the Tokyo Dome acoustics either, because like, when you hear them pop, when the crowd pop, you can really hear it. Like, there's an amazing pop when Hash gets in the mount, and you know, from that point on, his strikes, his palm strikes and his kicks, they get really big reactions as well. What it's got in its favour, particularly in contrast with the last two matches, is that Hashimoto is more giving to his opponent than Choshu and Sasaki.
Yeah, absolutely.
Despite being a bigger guy, he's more giving. And what it put me in mind of, there's a quite well-known match in 1994, which is Hashimoto versus Liger. At the time, that's a really great match. At the time, Hashimoto is the IWGP Heavyweight Champion and Liger is the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Champion. And Hashimoto is very giving to Liger. It's pretty even in terms of offense. Now, you could say that Hashimoto had more of an incentive to, you know, give Liger some stuff in that match because he was a guy inside the company rather than an outsider. And also, he was the junior heavyweight champion, and the junior heavyweights were quite prominently presented at the time. But still, I think it speaks to him that, like, despite the size differential, he's doing things like taking a really nasty DDT and stuff like that, and actually acting as though there is a risk that he might submit to a rear naked choke. He won't tap, though, but he might submit.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually almost a criticism of some men like Hashimoto. I've even seen this as a criticism leveled at Vader in some of his matches.
Yeah.
Where sometimes I think there's a school of thought that, and I'm not really sure where I sit on this, because it depends on the context, but there's a school of thought that says that some big men give too much in matches like this.
Yes.
I'm not sure about that, because I don't think that Hash ever does that in a way which ruins a match.
And I also think that if you have big men that always don't give stuff, you have to have that tied in, I think, to a very precise narrative function. You have to be telling a story, which is that this guy runs through people, is unbeatable, and will eventually have some kind of not comeuppance if it's a heel, or be knocked off his perch and have to find his way back if it's a face. And that's something which I think is maybe not applicable here as much, because I do think that Ash is just, I think simply he's just not a selfish wrestler.
No.
And I think there's a difference between that and, you know, not understanding your gimmick.
He was very much a guy who, he did what was right for the company, yes, or what company higher-ups dictated was right for him.
Sometimes I mean, to his detriment as an individual.
Yeah, I mean, look at his defeats to Naoya Ogawa, yeah, which really, really did irreparable harm to his aura, yeah, as a legit guy. Yeah. That's something we can maybe get into in a later episode. Absolutely. David is still cleaning up dog shit. So finish, very decisive. It's a sick DDT from Hashimoto and a spinning heel kick. That was one of his big spots, which knocks Nakano through the fucking ropes.
Yeah.
And then a brainbuster, which was Hashimoto's main finisher. Yeah. But he couldn't pin him with that, could he?
No, he can't.
No, he had to put on this weird...
No, he's back!
He had to put on... Oh, you're back! Hey! Yeah, no, he couldn't fucking win with the brainbuster, could he? He had to lock on this strange head scissors come arm bar to, like, get the victory via tap out.
Of course it's by fucking tap out. It's never not by fucking tap out.
There's more tap out here than, like, a fucking MMA gym.
There's more tap outs than me doing a fucking catch wrestling session at the fucking gym. Like, Jesus. Like.
Yeah, so David, now that you've returned from your excretory excavation, can you please tell us why you thought this match was dog shit?
This match, right? This is going to sound very strange, right? Do you ever go for a shit, right? And you don't remember doing the shit?
Shit! Sorry.
It's called a ghostie, right?
Yeah. No, you have a shit, that's not a ghostie. Right?
It's a ghostie is where you have a shit, and you can't remember having the shit, and when you wipe, there's nothing there. So it's as if you've not done one.
Oh, right. But you have. I didn't know the bit about not realizing you'd had one. I would always class it as you realize you've had one, but you go for the wipe and there's no evidence.
Yes. Because I've had that where I thought I'd passed out in the toilet for 25 minutes, just had no recollection of what had gone on. However, this match is the fucking ghostie of professional wrestling, right? Because I watched it and it was there, and I know I watched it. No evidence in my head that I actually watched this, because I can't remember a fucking thing about this. Nothing.
Jesus,
nothing. I don't even have notes. I didn't even write notes, because there was fuck all to this. I mean, I know you love Hashimoto, because he has a big teddy bear, right?
Yeah.
But, oh, yeah. It's not his best.
No, me and George were just saying that it's a disappointing match.
Yeah, it's very
disappointing. All these fucking, like... All these fucking fecal references, like we've become the Puro Puri Podcast. Am I right?
When I first typed in the Puro Puri Podcast, that's completely off. But when I typed that into Google the first time, it says, "Do you mean the Puro Puri Podcast?" I was like, well, "Now we fucking do, right?" I don't know anything about this match apart from Hashimoto was in it, and that's it. I didn't even know he tapped out. In the back of my mind, I knew he tapped out because it's fucking New Japan versus UWFI. That's just the way it's
standard.
I mean, I'd be taking a guess at the finish and I'd have probably said, did a UWFI guy tap out? But it's not because I knew. It's shit. There is nothing here. Nothing at all. It is a total mind wipe.
Yeah. I
have no recollection of this.
Yeah.
I think I wrote one note. I can't even remember what the note
was. It's made even less memorable for the fact that Hash is a guy that you're used to seeing have matches which are, you know, I can count 10 in, you know, of great Hashimoto matches that I will never forget as long as I live, you know? Like, so it can be odd seeing him, especially for guys like us who, I mean, when I was first getting into Japanese wrestling, there wasn't the availability of footage there is today. So you had shit cherry-picked for you. Like, and God, like, I mean, we...
you know, you'd sit there with 6 hour long tapes that you'd got, and it was like All Japan main event after All Japan main event after All Japan main event. Like, it just, I didn't even know there was like average Japanese wrestling, you know, like, yeah. You know, some of these guys. So yeah. It does make it worse, I
yeah,
think.
Yeah, like I said earlier, this match looked great on paper, yeah. And it really wasn't all that. It was better than... actually, I don't know if I recommend watching it over the Choshu versus Anjo match, because I think the Choshu versus Anjo match is entertaining just for the sheer train wreck fuckery of it.
Oh, yeah, I'd rather... Yeah.
There is a morbid curiosity to Choshu Anjo, and like I remember Choshu Anjo mainly because Choshu is a fucking wank camera on that. But, I can't tell you a single thing about this match. And that's the worst type of match for me. I would give me an absolutely dreadful match that I remember over this, because nothing.
Yeah. I mean, what I've got written here is, just as a general point about those three matches, is that how far is their general one-sidedness to do with the size differential, and how much of it is to do with wanting to get one over on UWFI? I think we've answered that in a great amount of detail, so I won't dwell on that too much. But the other one thing I wanted to ask before we move on to the main event is, can these matches be said to be shoot style at all, really?
Not particularly. No,
I don't think so. But then again, as we mentioned before, it wasn't the MO. Of these matches, I don't actually think by this point it's obvious really to be shoot style matches. The MO of these matches was to present shoot style as clashing with strong style and basically have strong style win. You know, so I think by this point they've given up on really bothering to infuse too much with shoot style, and it gets awkward.
Yeah, it does get very awkward. That's what we said. It is more strong style than shoot style. Yeah. Anyway, main event. Well, before the main event, Inoki and Saito have a little chat on commentary again, and I can't concentrate because this long-haired young man in the crowd behind them is just giving the camera sex eyes for about 2 minutes.
It is literally transfer deadline day on Sky Sports News, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is the vibrator in the ear outside Upton Park.
Do you know the look he gives, just to go back to an obscure football reference? Do you guys remember the careless whisper?
Yeah. Fuck me! I showed this to Sarah 3 days ago.
I hope someone did something for the Lincoln Ipswich game after McCarthy hit me.
I've got to give a shout out again to our mate Gary, who makes music and does visuals as well for his music, and once did an entire gig that was where the visuals were just based around that shot of Mick McCarthy.
Needless to say, I was profoundly rigid.
Preternaturally hard. Where were we? I'm completely lost now.
We were talking about sorry if you don't like talk about my massive raging boner, but like clearly don't want to talk about this match.
I would like at this point for us all to go on the count of three with a giant groan of despair at this fucking main event. God. So 1, 2, 3. Oh, fucking hell.
Yeah.
Carry on.
This match.
So, just to give you a bit of context, this is for not all the marbles. It is to... but it is a very important match. There's some really high stakes. It's to have UWFI draw level in the series and therefore restore a bit of parity, even if the layout of the match is suggested New Japan seniority. It is also for the IWGP Heavyweight Championship. And that's a huge deal, or it would be an outsider winning this, as we've said in episode 3. Kensuke Sasaki lost a non-title match to an outsider and gave up the championship because of the shame of letting down his company. So this is a huge deal. It's Keiji Muto, the IWGP Heavyweight Champion, versus the guy we've mentioned quite copiously in episode 4, UWFI head honcho Nobuhiko Takada. Takada started out in New Japan, as I think we've said before, and he's looking to be the first man to be a junior heavyweight, tag team, and heavyweight champion in New Japan. So a lot on the line. And you know, I'm sure they're going to give us a contest worthy of these stakes.
Yeah, you'd think so, right? Let's just try and maybe break this match down. I mean, as you've said, this is a match that we are talking about as being on one of the biggest stages in one of the biggest feuds that made the most amount of money, one of the most amounts of money in Japanese wrestling history, really. This is, I honestly don't think I have ever seen, especially I'd say for the first 70% of this match, a more disappointing main event to a show of this size. I'm struggling to think of one. I don't know if you guys can think of one.
I'm trying to think. There's got, oh well, you can maybe argue some of Triple H WrestleMania ones, like Triple H Randy Orton.
Yes, that's a great shout.
That's true. You know what? I think it's better than this.
Wow.
And guess what? I mean, people that know me will know this. I despise Triple H and Randy Orton as workers. They are not guys that I like. And Takada, I really like. And Muto,
he has his moments.
He has some great runs.
He's a good wrestler.
So that's such a sin, really. When you think,
yeah,
about
I think it. Maybe it's because, like, I guess you kind of expected more from these guys.
Yeah,
that's probably what makes it. You know, I'm not saying it's inferior to Triple H, Randy Orton, because you know I'd rather have my eyes scooped out with a melon baller than watch Triple H versus Randy Orton.
No, I just to clarify, I'm not necessarily I think it is superior as that match
right,
is superior
okay.
to a wrestling match. I'm saying that I would probably rather watch that again.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I'm not going to disagree with that. I think the Triple H, Randy Orton, I do think it's better than this.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's get into
let's get into
the sheer fucking hellness of it all. Muto really over here. He gets a lot of chance. As we said before, this is certainly not a split crowd. This is a New Japan crowd, and the UWFI guys are in Booger Red's yard. There's some decent stuff with there's a few dueling heel hooks in the early going. Muto's willing to let Takada get the better of him in exchanges, maybe because they're comparable in size and there's a certain incentive to keep Takada strong as, you know, by far the biggest star in the UWFI posse. And the problem is that the commentators are trying to make Takada's submissions, like his toe holds, seem like a big deal, like they could end the match at any moment. But the crowd aren't biting and Muto isn't biting.
No,
that's the problem. Muto is—he's kind of just laying on his feckin' ass.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually—it's gone down into infamy. So, you know, this part of the match and other sections as well as being the go-to sort of section of a match that people look at when they are trying to argue for what in recent years become kind of a revisionist position, I suppose, when it comes to Muto, which is that, you know, the book on him for years was that he was this great worker that was having these fantastic main events. And in the last sort of, few years or so, maybe 10 years or so, certainly in places like EWO and that kind of place, it's been shown up to be, I think, a bit of a lie. I mean, this is an example of I'll outright say this. I am not someone who will ever get in a wrestling ring and wrestle. Keiji Muto is 1,000,000,000,000,000,000 times the wrestler that I will ever be. But in this match, he's fucking lazy.
He really is.
Yeah, this reminds me of, you know, when you were at school. Remember, it was the last day of school.
Yeah.
And you would go to school and everything would be great. And you're excited for the holidays. And then there was always that one class where they would make you do the lesson. And you're like, what the fuck's the point? And like,
yeah.
I'm half expecting Takeda to ask if they can play Trivial Pursuit. Because it's just fucking, like, I had a history class which relentlessly did this every year, but they didn't make us do a lesson. Instead, they made us watch Schindler's List every year on the last day of school.
That's a great way to G you up for the holidays. Party.
Holiday, yeah, all those poor Jews. Oh my God, it's like...
Fucking hell.
Like, every fucking year, Schindler's List, right? Probably more action packed than this. Right? This is proper end of school Muto.
Yeah,
it's become notorious. And I mean, can you guys maybe? I don't know. I would say that it does pick up. I will give it that.
It does. Yeah, the first 10 minutes are rotten, but it does pick up.
Yeah, there's a bit I like, which I think maybe the teachers told Muto, like, right, look, if you're good for the first half, then I'll put on the final episode of Blackadder Goes Forth for you. So he thinks, oh, shit, maybe make a bit of an effort. So there's some pretty slow but reasonably hard-fought grappling, albeit with not much selling. That's broken when Muto gets enough of a dominant position to bounce off the ropes and attempt that, you know, that quite rapid elbow drop that he does. Takano moves out of the way.
The one that Dean Ambrose nicks now.
Yeah, the one that Dean Ambrose tries to do. And I think that's a nice example of incorporating pro wrestling spots, which you would never do in a shoot fight, into this more mat-based psychology. I think Takano tries his best with, you know, Muto gets fired up with some headbutts and some stomps and kicks. And Takano does a good job of looking shaken up before he fires back. So it seems like, you know, one guy is, like, trying to bring some emotion.
Yeah.
There's some of the good moves, like some knees from Takada countered with this amazing, like, shooty release German from Muto. You know, the kind we talked about in episode 4, where they just get behind you and just throw you back, dump you on your head. And then there's a backdrop, and then Muto misses a moonsault, which I think BJ Penn was really known for in UFC, doing the moonsault. Classic shoot technique.
Yeah. Like, I mean, that I'll go as far as to say this, which is not, this is damning this match with faint praise. That release German thing, that spot's probably my favourite spot of the whole match.
Like, yeah, it's absolutely lovely.
It's nothing special. You know, it's beautiful, but it's not. It's the kind of thing that you see guys do on the indie circuit every week now, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I like the bits at the end, like David said. There was some good stuff. Finally, an armbar out of nowhere gets a minor reaction from the crowd, probably because they know Takada's an actual threat. And even more when he locks in another one after a backdrop driver. And they do this, the classic UWFI psychology, where Muto, as you would if you were a shoot fighter, locks his hands together to try and prevent the arm being hyperextended. It's not like, you ever watch, I know we've ragged on him already in this episode, but fucking Alberto Del Rio, you know, those matches he used to do, where he'd do the armbar and he'd have it in for about, 4 hours. And then the person with the arm fully extended, mind you, and whoever he was wrestling would be selling, but be basically fine and then crawl towards the ropes and then, you know, usually win. You know, that's because in UWFI, if Takada had the armbar, it's basically his finisher. If he had the armbar on you and he fully extended the arm, that was it. So they've sort of met them halfway with the pro wrestling and the shoot style psychology.
To be fair, Muto does, he scrambles to get out of that armbar reaching for the rope.
Yeah.
I really like the way that he tried to escape from it. As well as that, I like the follow-up where Muto just goes hell for leather. He just desperately tackles Takeda right into the ropes, trying to kill Takeda's momentum, just trying to take him down, stop him, slow him down, which I thought was a really good part of the match. Muto was like, right, if he locks it in, I'm fucked. I need to stop him and try and regroup.
I think that's selling fear more than selling pain, if you get my drift.
And I was just gonna say that to me though is why Muto is such a frustrating wrestler, and I've watched quite a lot of Muto throughout my years. He can, you know, he can do things in a match like that where you think, wow, that's pretty cool. I like what you've done there. That's drawn me into this otherwise kind of standard spot, you know. But he just doesn't apply himself, it seems, that often. He's happy to coast through entire sections of matches sometimes. Now, I will say that I'm beginning to watch a lot of matches from the year 2000 at the moment for a project that's happening on PWO. I've already seen a fair bit of Muto's sort of 2000 run, where I know that there's some very highly thought of things in there that kind of come out of nowhere. So look, the guy has had some very good matches. I'm not saying he hasn't, but it's just so frustrating when you see the kind of stuff he's capable of, you know?
He's clearly so talented, and yet, you know, this is probably the biggest match of his life at this point.
Yeah.
And, you know, he just kind of acts like he can't be bothered. I quite like the finish. So Muto counters a kick with the sort of Fujinami dragon screw and gets a really huge pop, locking in the figure four. And they do that great spot, which you often saw Giant Up the Rubber doing with the Destroyer, where you know how at the end of the figure four, like, they lock it in by basically bringing their other leg down onto the leg.
Yeah, to alleviate the pressure, yeah.
Yeah, and Takara's holding Muto's leg up to stop him locking the hold in fully. Like, I really like that. And there's some really cool, like, striking sequences. Takara kicks his way out of another dragon screw.
At this point, the crowd actually get into it.
Oh, yeah, they go absolutely. Yeah.
Blood, and so does the crowd. And Takeda just puts him in the face to stop the second dragon screw because he knows that, you know, Takeda's like, he's on a bad wheel. He needs to stop this now.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a great bit where he does some palm strikes and hits a head kick. And they actually start doing the 10 count, as in Takeda's going to win by knockout. And Muto beats the count and then gets enziguri'd, but for some reason just weirdly no-sells it and puts the figure four on. And now we'll let our audience have a little play. We'll make this a bit more of an interactive podcast. See if you can guess what the finish of this match is going to be. Is it going to be? You can play two, David. You can play two.
Yeah. For various reasons, David's had a bit of a tough year. We want to try and get him a lot of money today.
He's got two dogs shitting on the floor.
He's got a lot of dogs shitting everywhere. He can't even send cans through the mail anymore. Let's try and get him a lot of money.
Okay, so your options are, is it A, Nobuhiko Takara reverses the figure four and rolls up Muto into a small package for the 1-2-3? Is it B, Takara goes absolutely ape, kicks him in the head until he stops moving, and then locks in the armbar? Muto taps out, the first tap out for a New Japan wrestler. Is it 3, Nobuhiko Takara obliterates Keiji Muto in some sort of Dragon Ball Z-like fury? Or is it D, Nobuhiko Takara submits to a move that has not been a viable finisher in Japan since the 70s? So I'll give you a bit of time to think, you at home, give you a few seconds.
Well, it is a tough one. Chris, can I phone a friend? I have a friend, his name is Daniel. I think he might know this one. I remember going to the pub and him talking about this match at some point. So I think he might know this. He's an anarchist. So I don't know if he has a phone line, but if you want to give it a go anyway. So go ahead. I'll phone a friend.
Hello? Hello? Is that mum? Is that mum?
Daniel, I need your help.
You're not my real dad!
Daniel, I'm a £200 a millionaire, right?
I need your help. You spent £200 in the bookies?
Big money, no. I'm in the big money, 200 quid a millionaire.
I told you that.
I need your answer. I've got 30 seconds. Fucking shut up, I've got 30 seconds, right?
All right, sorry. Yeah. Hello, Chris.
Takeda Muto, Tokyo Dome, October 95.
Oh, yeah, remember right? it well. Yeah,
remember it well.
Yeah.
A, does Takeda reverse the figure four and roll him up? B, does Takeda just go mental and lock him in an armbar? 3, does Takeda turn Super Saiyan and destroy Muto? Or 4, does Takeda tap out clean to a move that's not a shoot move? We're up against the clock here, come on.
You know the fucking answer, he taps out!
How sure are you?
100%! I remember that feud like the back of my fucking hand. Taps out. We all fucking tap out of the fucking Jesse.
Cheers, Daniel. Chris.
All right.
Chris. I'm going to go for D. Stop corpsing, Chris.
Well, I mean, you were on, you know, a satisfying and well-booked feud with New Japan and UWFI having some nice back and forth. Maybe UWFI going over in the first instance, therefore making them an even greater invading force and leading to a bigger monetary and critical payoff later. But we don't want to give you that! The answer's D!
No way! Never!
Yeah. That was...
I fucking hate this feud! I fucking hate it! Stop making them tap out! I mean, for fuck's sake! It's not hard! I'd have taken a fuck finish. I'd have taken a dusty finish. I'd have taken Takeda's boots, are not regulation boots. Just qualified. Yeah. I'd have fucking taken it, right? But no, that's not allowed. That's not on the fucking menu today. Today's course of the day is fucking UWFI starlet tapping it in the main event to a move that's not even a fucking shoot submission move.
Yeah, while David decondenses his windows because of all the steam that's blown out of his ears.
What's the number for the Samaritans? They don't know what, because I fucking need it about now.
Hey, mate, I suffer from depression. I've got it on fucking speed dial.
After watching this match, I don't fucking believe it.
Yeah, I was fine. I was fine before.
It's fine. His shoot has anxiety. We can make these jokes.
Yeah. Can this match actually just fuck off now?
No. We're going to talk about the figure four. So just to give you a bit of context, the figure four was banned in UWFI matches because, as we said in episode four, they didn't do any, and in this episode actually, they didn't do any holds which were not shoot submission holds. They didn't go for any moves that you would not do in a real fight. And it hadn't really been a viable finisher in Japan, as the wonderful Chris Tarrant informed us earlier, since the 70s. It was very much associated with top American stars like Jack Briscoe and the Destroyer. The Destroyer in particular, when he came over to Japan in the 60s, the figure four was... Yeah, you may not believe it now if you're used to modern wrestling, but the figure four was fucking death. Like, no one got out of the figure four. If he had it on you, you would lose. And then in the 80s, Ric Flair won matches in it with it. But like you've probably seen Ric Flair matches. His figure four is a potent move, but it's pretty easily countered and it's pretty escapable.
Yeah.
So not only did New Japan go over and really look dominant, as if that wasn't bad enough, they Choshu booked it so that New Japan UWFI's top guy would submit to a move that was a pro wrestling hold. It was not a shoot hold. It was a pro wrestling hold.
I want to ask a question here. Can you think of a worse hold for Takeda to tap to? Maybe like a trapezius nerve pinch. Even then, I can maybe believe that. Because, I mean, somebody pinches you in the nerve, it fucking hurts. I can believe. Chinese burn, maybe?
Oh, I've got it. The colossal clutch.
Oh, for fuck's sake. The iron claw.
That was what I was going to say was the iron claw. That was the first one that came up.
That was the most over finisher in Japan at one point.
Hey, yeah, we'll cover a match maybe one day in which the claw is used to incredible kind of dramatic. Yeah.
The claw is the law. Yeah.
So just briefly summing up. The original idea...
This match was shit and I hated it.
I wouldn't go that far, but I think it certainly was very, very disappointing for what was at stake in kayfabe and the importance of the show. The original idea was for Takada to win and then to actually win the rematch against Muto as well before dropping the belt to another wrestler. And for whatever reason, Choshu, that didn't transpire. What the upshot of it was that Takada's reputation as a legit guy took an absolutely huge hit at the next UWFI show. He was booed really heavily by the UWFI fans for letting them down, and he ended up just getting the house mic and swearing at them, which is a great way to diffuse tensions and very Takada-ish if you know anything about his like shoot personality. I would say is that, and reading the Wrestling Observers from around about this time, there apparently was a lot of criticism of Takada's performance in this match. And now we've ragged on Muto, rightly so in my opinion, but do we think Takada should share some of the blame for the match being what it was?
Well, I mean, the problem is that obviously Takada is a shoot worker, but he has wrestling experience. What was the promotion that he was in?
It was New Japan at first.
He was in New Japan, and he said those matches with Vader. Takeda can work a very good, worked match. He can do a very good worked match.
I think that Takada often works better as in pro style than he does in shoot style sometimes.
I feel that I don't necessarily think that this was Takada's fault. I feel that maybe the style he was working wasn't very good, but this brings me on to a different point about this entire card. The whole New Japan UWFI thing, it's a great thing in concept, but when you're 8 matches in, I don't want to fucking see this style ever again.
Well, like, luckily, we're doing 2 more episodes on it.
Every match was the same. There was so much preamble. It was like the wrestling equivalent of Fletch and Sav. just waiting for the good bit at 12:15 for the actual fucking game to come on. You're waiting 10 minutes. No, every single match, like, I kind of realised over the last couple of months, I hate modern day submission wrestling, right? I hate it so much because nobody can do it right, and it fucking annoys me because there's so many different ways to do a good submission match. You know, you've got your shoot style, you've got your, you know, your Lucha Maestros match, and there's so many, and like the British style with the escapology out of holds and things like that. One of my main criticisms of like modern day WWE, especially the cruiserweights, is that they are focused on, we need a submission bit, we need a bit of submission wrestling. And you have 4 or 5 minutes of headlocks, arm ringers, wrist locks.
Yeah.
You know, oh, it's just, you know, token moves. There's not actually anything behind them. And I felt that this is the same here, and that this was just moves for the sake of moves. It was only later on when he did the Dragon Skull leg whip that really, like, you know, Takeda started selling the leg. It was at that point that was, you know, it went on. It was a good match, regardless of the result. It was a good match up until, no, from that, the first Dragon School leg whip on, but the first 10 minutes is just, it's just pissing about. And I feel that that's not necessarily Takada's fault, because I feel that this has been this was the direction they were looking for. They wanted to have this submission. You know, we need to have this 10 minutes of just, you know, holds and pissing about. I don't think they said it in quite a, you know, eloquent way as I did, but you know what I mean? Like, they were like, we need to have feeling out processes and things like that. And they didn't need it. I really didn't need it. I can't remember if I said it on the previous recording we did of this or in episodes, the next episode. But if it was up to me, if I'd booked this, I would have booked Takeda versus Muto to have, you know, a match. Like, take the last, was this like 18 minutes or something like that? Take the last eight minutes of this, stretch it out, and then, you know, work on that. You know, it should be high impact. This should be a wrestling match that Takeda is working. It shouldn't be Muto is working a UWFI match, because it's a New Japan show. And then Takeda would still beat him. And then the next time, you would have the great Muta come out, bring back the Muta makeup, because it wasn't very long after this that he did bring back the Muta makeup. And you can put in a bit of that mysticism and smoke and mirrors and things like that, and have a bit more of a gimmicky match. But this just didn't work at all for me.
Yeah, I think it was like an unsatisfying hybrid of the two styles, and you really got something which was neither here nor there when it came down to it.
Yeah. This should have been a wrestling match, not a shoot match. Absolutely.
I agree 100%. So I guess before we wrap up this section, any final thoughts on this card as a whole? We've kind of run through, I think, most of our feelings on it, but anything that we've missed that you'd like to wrap up with, guys?
I have one statement and one statement alone to say. Don't mess with Ricky Choshu and deny him his hole.
No. Like, oh my goodness. Like, I've got nothing else to add. I'm all out on this particular card.
So am I. I think I probably still would recommend watching it if you're interested about this feud. If only for not because any matches are, like, I think the only matches I would say are particularly great are the opener Liger versus Sano and the last half of the main event. And even those I wouldn't say great, I would say good. But at the same time, I think watching it for the occasion and just the curiosity about how the interpromotional dynamics and the strange crowd reactions to the sort of halfway house of pro wrestling style and shoot style that they were seeing, I think it's maybe worth a watch just for that, really. But as a wrestling show, it's really not that great.
Yeah, no. I mean, in terms of historical context, I feel that, it's definitely worth a watch. Yeah. And certainly the Liger-Sano match, I really enjoyed it and think it's a really good addition to the canon of Liger-Sano. It's definitely, if you're watching Liger-Sano matches, definitely give this a go, because it's a really good match and you'll enjoy it. You pretty much nailed it. The opening tag, Otani being a dick, Liger-Sano, last 8 minutes or so of the main event, all you need, really.
And I mean, I guess to pick up on this, and not to sort of get on a soapbox about how people should watch wrestling or anything, but I do think that there is an awful lot of people these days, and this is why I think shows like Raw end up looking and being structured the way they are. There are a lot of people who just want to watch wrestling for everything that happens in the ring, and they watch it in isolation, and they don't connect it to really any kind of historical understanding or context. And this means that a lot of people live very much in the here and now when they watch wrestling. And they are, you know, and that's why I think matches kind of look the same in a lot of promotions these days, because they serve that kind of in the moment watching. But I think that there is certainly a groundswell in the last few years of people that want to watch wrestling because we view it as, you know, not to get too up ourselves, but we do view it as kind of culturally important, right? So people should watch things like this where, you know, maybe the matches are kind of disappointing, because it's a fascinating time capsule. And, you know, you've got stuff like Choshu and Joe, which is just, you know, a complete wreck.
Yes.
But that's okay. You know, you don't have to watch wrestling to necessarily, watch 4.5-star matches all the time. Sometimes you should watch wrestling because wrestling is an important piece of culture in some senses, in some circles, and it has a history. And and watching stuff like this helps put into context, you know, for example, if you watch the Hashimoto match in this and you've never seen Hashimoto before, and then someone gives you a load of the really fucking great Hashimoto matches, you're going to have your mind blown, you know? So don't shy away from things that, don't have a fantastic in-ring product, especially when they're this historically important. Another great example was this, I recently watched the entire show where Hogan beats the Iron Sheik
at
the start of Hulkamania.
Yeah.
It's not a great show at all. Really, but incredibly interesting, because you get to put things in a historical context, and I think that's important.
Yes.
As you both well know, I am by no means dictated by the star rating system. I love just as much a 1-star match as I do a 5-star match. There is a lot of positivity to be found. I know it doesn't sound like it because I've moaned for the last hour and a half. I made millionaire references, but if you just sit and watch 4.5-star matches all the time, it's going to get boring after a while.
It does, because you've got nothing to compare them to. Like, this is why, you know, we say this all the time on this podcast, but when we watch Raw, like, you know, I saw someone the other day having a pop, I think it was maybe Alexa Bliss on SmackDown right now. Look, I know Alexa Bliss isn't the greatest worker in the world, but she's a young worker. She's trying to find her way in terms of, you know, she's got great personality. Yeah. She's just trying to maybe add a few little things in ring to get to the right place. And, you know, people seem to want everyone to, like, be born as this incredible, great 5-star worker right away. Look at all these assholes that bang on about Nia Jax or Braun Strowman because they can't. It's like, you know, there needs to be a diversity of stuff, and that should be the same in your watching as well. It doesn't mean you have to sit there watching, you know, god-awful, boring stuff like some of the matches in this all the time, but every now and again, just put something on and get into it, and maybe just let it wash over you. And you know, if it's shit, it's shit. But you've got a million 5-star matches. YouTube exists now. Dailymotion exists. There's a million 5-star matches you can watch tomorrow. This is interesting and it's important. So, yeah, we've slagged it off a bit. But, yeah, you know, as fans, we are people that want to try and get a handle on where the industry was at the time.
I think the perfect metaphor would be my dogs, who are currently being assholes. They are dicks, right? They eat everything. They try and destroy my house. They shit and piss everywhere, and they bark back at me. But I love them, really.
They're from Lincolnshire. Yeah. They're going to be cunts.
Yeah. But every now and again, they have a fantastic match with Victor Zangief.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it makes up for that disappointing semi-main.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think perhaps that's probably a good time to finish that for that episode. Okay, so that wraps it up for this show, and we are going to keep looking at New Japan and the UWFI in some future episodes. But just before we go, we have some shit to plug. Guys, do you want to do some plugging?
Yeah, so you can find us on Facebook at the Purr Purr Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Purr Podcast.
How did we get that? How did we get at Purr Podcast?
I know! How has no one else got Purr Podcast?
What the fuck?
Yeah, that is a weird one. Yeah, at Purr Podcast. That's us. Enjoy our antics as we bam up Tesco over Big Daddy Meltzer's star ratings. And we also have, of course, you can listen to this on SoundCloud at the Purr Purr Podcast. We're on iTunes as well. And excitingly, we are now on Pro Wrestling Only / Place to Be Nation. I just want to say thanks so much to those guys for having us on. Because at the end of the day, we're just three blokes talking shite about Japanese wrestling and the RAR and lower league football and stuff like that. And it really means a lot that someone's taken a chance on us and enabled us to put our stuff across to a wider audience who are hopefully enjoying it.
Yeah, absolutely.
As well as that, I would like to give a big thank you to Voices of Wrestling, purely because they invited us to be in their match of the year poll, which for me, I know it might not seem like very much, but for me, it makes me feel really good, like in terms of to be, you know, that people are thinking, you know, this, you know, you have like an actual voice, people are listening to you. And we'll let you, you know, let you decide on your 10, you know, favourite matches of the year. It meant a lot to me to be, you know, included in that. I think I've been barred after my choices. but, you know, thanks for the opportunity for that 1 year. But no, well, thank you very much to Voices of Wrestling. Top guys. And they have some great podcasts as well. You should listen to them. But not
No, massive shout out to those guys, definitely. That was really nice to be able to put a ballot in there. I guess the last things that I would plug would be, the Purpuri podcast was born out of a Facebook group, which has now become a website of our own. It's related to the Twitter feed as well. You find that I maintain the double foot stomp is silly.com. Also like to thank the Headlock newsletter,
yes.
David.
Yes, the Headlock newsletter.
Yeah. We'd really like to thank the Headlock newsletter because those guys have been linking. It's a newsletter that sends out an email. Is it every week, I think?
Yes, it's an email every week with articles from around the world of wrestling that that person enjoys. It's also usually get a free match from it as well. Usually a bit of merch that, you know, that you want to go buy.
They've featured quite a lot of articles that we've had on our website. I maintain the double foot stomp is silly.com. And just so as you you know, guys, shout out to you for that. But we are changing our name as much as you might want us to.
No, we're not.
No chance. So yeah, I think that's pretty much everything that we need to plug, guys. I think.
Okay.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Yep. Cool. Okay. In that case, then we'll catch you on the next episode. And take it easy.
Speaking of hell, our next match is...
Bear with me for a moment. Bear with me for a moment. 2 seconds, sorry, I need to...
Yeah, I need to slash as well, so that's really good timing. All right.
Sorry.
That's all right.
This probably won't go in, but since we last recorded this podcast, I got two dogs, and they're arseholes. just thought they'd let them know.
You say this won't go in, and then you give me something as perfect as that for the weird little bits that I do for the segue. It's like that's going in.
All I'm saying is that, you know, I think it was the last episode that we mentioned about shoot style in Japan kind of going off the rails, not really done well. My dogs, they're bringing shoot style back. They roll, they're fucking rolling, and then Colin bites Freya's nose because he's a dick. And then Freya bites her back. Is it
like Valley Tudo then?
I mean, can have a look at the moment. Because, I mean, look at this. Can you see them? Freya has Colin in side control right now.
Kimura, look for the Kimura. You're gonna have the jelly out there. Oh. Out.
I'm tempted to try and get them on Fight Pass. I'm not gonna lie. I think they'd fucking take them.
Easy. That could probably be on like the first prelim of a Cage Warriors fight.
I think they're more trained. and they can't even shit on a mat.
Yeah, who can shit on a mat? Mickey Choshu.
Waiting in the wings, a man about to fight for his political life. Deep breath and into the limelight.
Anjo! Yoji! Yoji Anjo's 37, 5'11", 200 pounds. This is his debut in Pride Fighting Championships, but boss, his past does involve the Gracie family.
We must destroy this double-dealing, deceitful, incompetent, shallow, inefficient, ineffective, corrupt, mendacious, fraudulent, shameful, lying government once and for all.
Okay, now, a long time ago, Yoji, that was in 94, went to Hickson Gracie's Academy and he challenged him there to a grudge match right there at the dojo. Now, Hickson got the better of him and he beat him up, but he always wanted to fight Hickson again. And now, at least, he's going to get a shot and another Gracie. So for him, this is kind of a grudge match.
That was a lie. I will fight, 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 and fight again to save the country that I love. To fight for them. To be strong for them. To be here for them. And together, to win for them.
I don't know, David, you got any thoughts on this?
Hello?
Hello? Are we still talking about this fucking match?
The Hashimoto one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, I spent the last couple of minutes cleaning up dog shit, right? And speaking of dog shit, I hated this match and it was boring as fuck. And I know what dog shit is, so I fucking cleared it up and put it in the bin just there.
Okay, good.
You thought you were safe from dog shit. I think dog shit's maybe a bit strong for this match, but like, it isn't that good. One thing I would say in its favour, though.
Should we just let David outline why he didn't like it so much?
Yeah, go on then. That's a good idea.
Fucking hell. It's just, leave that matter alone, fuck's sake. Right, sorry, I've got dogs all over the place. Right. This match is fucking bollocks, right? Right, bear with me for a moment. Talk amongst yourself, right?
I'm staying silent. Leave this out.
Wrestling. This is their first ever head-to-head meeting. You know, the year 1996 was certainly very different for these two men. I think it'd have to be termed the high watermark for the 21-year-old Mysterio. He had that four-month reign as the Cruiserweight champion and really made a name for himself in Japan and the United States. 96, though, was maybe one of the toughest years that Jushin Liger has endured in a 13-year career. Back in August, Liger underwent surgery to remove a brain tumor. He's made a remarkable recovery with a return to the ring just over 2 months later.
No.